You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 25th of May 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to episode 255 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Tom Edwards.
On today's programme...
A British company is exploring for oil.
My work is to manage the park, to ensure that it's protected. Any oil-related activities are illegal.
All the armed groups will want their slice of the cake.
We'll meet the journalist behind a new documentary that unveils the threats menacing Africa's oldest national park, Virunga, in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Plus, we'll meet the owner of Granta, Sigrid Rausing, who has a new book out about her time in a collective farm in Estonia.
Also ahead, historian Federico Finchelstein will discuss his new book on the origins of Argentina's fascism and the so-called Dirty War.
All that, plus some music and next week's news today, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Tom Edwards, hello.
Steve Bloomfield, a very good day to you.
So we're without Andrew and without Rob.
I know, I feel slightly lost. I consider
really?
Them to both be my mentors in so many ways.
Well, that's worrying.
No, it's hard not to have them here. But yeah. I must say, at the same time, it's a delight to be spending my Sunday lunchtime with you, Steve. How have the last 7 days treated you? We've almost had a kind of a flicker of early summer, haven't we, here in London?
We have. We've had a flicker of early summer. It was quite hot. Apparently, in fact, it was very hot on Monday, but I wasn't here because I was in Berlin. It's been a bit of a German week.
It has indeed, haven't we? We've had a whole host of our staff and operatives at large in Germany this week.
I was in Berlin on Monday. Tyler and Sophie were in Munich on Tuesday. And then Rob and Andrew were in Frankfurt on Wednesday.
Indeed.
And then I think are still there now. They're still somewhere in Germany.
They are, continuing
their
travels.
On their way back.
How did Berlin treat you?
Berlin was lovely.
What a city it is.
It is. It's a cracking city. It was really good fun. And albeit rather brief. But very good, and also allowed me to get a little bit of a feel for whether it deserves to perhaps rise up the rankings in the quality of life survey we're putting together right now for the July-August issue of the magazine.
It is always hotly anticipated, isn't it, Steve?
It is, actually.
Do you want to give away any little hints, any little tips to our lucky listeners?
No, okay. What I will say is there are two new entries.
That's pretty exciting.
There will be a surprising... highest riser.
Pyongyang, is it?
We like a big riser, don't we?
Careful, Steve.
Sorry. Someone has to do these jokes when Andrew's not there.
That's true. There wouldn't be enough casual smut otherwise.
And there will be some surprises at the top.
No, that's... I was excited already. That's just brought...
It's raised it to
fever pitch.
That's enough, isn't it? As a little bit of a taste.
That's a nice teaser. Good teasing work.
So that's the other thing we're doing at the moment is upstairs on the editorial floor, hard at work, putting together the July-August issue, which is, I think the technical term is a monster. It's a monster. Not a nightmare. It's all going to be fine, but it's quite big.
That's a challenge. That's a challenge, Steve. You need to rise to a challenge.
It sounds like you're about to break into song.
I was going to, but
if this was Monocle Weekly, the musical,
I wouldn't have a role in it. Rest assured.
We should do that.
We could do it.
You know how
we?
Like they did one episode of Buffy was a musical.
I didn't know that, but now I do.
I have
got one idea though, Steve. If you'll come with me on this little meander,
it's not to do music, is it?
It is. I'm just thinking, who could possibly deliver one of the most sort of moving, haunting bits of. Vocal work, if the Weekly did indeed turn into a musical.
I think it would need to be someone from Long Island.
I think so too, and someone who could deliver, a haunting and beautiful falsetto. Shall we hear from him now?
Let's. Ladies and gentlemen, he doesn't get his own intro music.
There he was.
But there he is with his falsetto.
La la la.
Danny Giacopelli.
I won't do that ever again.
You have to give the public what they want, Danny.
That's why I'm here. So, shall we look at the news?
Yeah, next week's... We should remind our listeners, as if they needed reminding, that this is the time for next week's news now. What will be making the headlines, Danny, in the next 7 days? Normally, this is the seat that I'm in, but once again, I'm in the big chair, so it falls
right. They want to do it right this week. So right now, there's lots and lots to look at in terms of politics, actually today and tomorrow. There's Colombia, there's Ukraine, there's Egypt, and there's India. It's kind of nonstop. So today, obviously, is the Colombian presidential election. Today, is the Ukraine presidential election, and tomorrow, on Monday, is the Egyptian one. And I should also add, tomorrow, Narendra Modi is sworn in as the Indian Prime Minister. So lots to look out for. And yeah.
Lots of great political action this weekend.
Could I go so far as to describe it as an electoral bonanza?
You could possibly say that, yeah.
I mean,
we've been covering Colombia all week on Monocle 24. Daphne's put together a great series on the future of the country, its politics, its culture.
Talked a bit about football, didn't we, Danny?
We have, yeah. We've talked about football.
By which I mean soccer, as you would understand it.
It's indeed soccer. Lots to look out on that front. And also, a week from today, so Sunday the 1st of June, Kenya is marking a Madaraka Day, which I believe you're interested in, Steve.
I'm not interested in it, but I know a bit about it. And well done on the pronunciation.
Thank you very much. So what, it's the day of independence from...
Yeah. So they'll celebrate getting independence, winning independence from Britain.
The 50th. I mean, that's surely worthy of particular
celebration. Yeah, well, in fact, it's more when they became a republic. So there was an interim period of from when they became independent to when they became a republic. There will be, I imagine, celebrations at either Uhuru Park or Nyayo Stadium.
They got full independence on the 12th of December.
There we are.
So... We have a good time for that.
Yeah.
It's amazing. You just knew that off the top of your head, Danny.
Yeah.
I'm impressed.
The facts are just at his fingertips.
Encyclopedia.
Actually, quite literally at his fingertips as he was sort of looking at the page, running his finger across it. But a difficult time for Kenya 50 years on because of all the problems they're obviously having at the moment with terrorist attacks, with corruption, with all sorts of other things as well. Yes, it will be muted. Celebrations, perhaps, is fair to say. Yeah.
This might also interest both of you. It's Geek Pride Day today.
Now, why do you think that's going to interest?
It's lots of eye spectacles being worn around the table here, including myself. But it's Geek Pride Day.
What happens on Geek Pride Day?
Is there a big parade?
Well,
oh, please tell me there is.
No, I don't think there's a parade. It started in
isn't it?
It started about 2006, I think. But geeks around the world celebrated. Originally, it was chosen to commemorate the release of Star Wars. But yeah, there you go. I mean,
why isn't it celebrated on May the 4th then?
Why would it be May the 4th?
May the 4th be with you.
Oh my God.
Oh, come on. Have you not heard that before?
I have never heard that.
That's pretty. Again, that is Tuckian. So in many ways, the weekly is the spot.
I fell right into
it.
That, really. With a seamless transition right now, a Spanish town is voting to change their name from, well, the English version is Kill Jews. So it's Castrillo Mata Judios. And it's a
great Spanish accent there.
Thank you very much. I think our Spanish listeners would appreciate that. So,
and am I right in thinking just
it's an Inquisition era name?
Browsing through some of the documents you've provided here, Danny, it was called the Hill of Jews, and then it was changed to Kill Jews.
Do you think that was just a casual change? Somebody was asking for directions.
The first time that happened, didn't somebody say, "I'm pretty sure it's Hill"? No.
No, it's definitely Kill.
It's an absolutely extraordinary
story. That was the response.
So what's happening?
So
the residents are trying to petition to change the name, right?
There's a referendum.
And there is someone saying, well, you know, this is a general problem across Spain because, of course, lots of people also have the surname Matamoros, which means kill Moors.
Right, exactly. So it's an Inquisition kind of era thing. There you go. And let's end with really a bit of
just
fun.
One thing about this, I could be wrong, but okay. I'm pretty sure, you know the famous Renaissance organist Antonio Cabezon? I think he was actually born in...
I do actually have him on my iPod
in
right now.
Really? It just popped in there, yeah.
Yeah.
The things
well,
you
there
know.
We are.
And finally, gentlemen, Tuesday
Did you
is...
just Google that?
No, I have no Googling facilities available, so...
Tuesday, it's Memorial Day in the U.S. It's the day when my fellow countrymen go get hot dogs and barbecues and wave flags.
I thought that was every day, Danny.
It's every day.
And wave flags, yeah, every day.
You can officially wear certain pieces of clothing, I think. Obviously, it commemorates the military dead, so it's not really a very joyous occasion, but somehow over the years it's turned into a joyous occasion where you just really get drunk and eat lots of barbecue.
Okay, well... There we are. That was a news review.
I like that news review, Danny. That was good. It had lots of good stuff in there.
Is it worthy, do you think, of us producing a little jingle for him next time?
On balance, I'm going to say no.
Yeah, I feel it wasn't
I thought you've already chosen the Godfather theme tune because you're horrible bigoted man.
No, I'm trying to. Oh, I need to think of things that are from Jersey for you for next time.
It's Long Island.
Jersey.
There we are.
Jersey.
Danny Jacopelli. That was the news, sort of. Lots more to come here on The Weekly with me and Tom after this. The Virunga National Park in eastern Congo is Africa's oldest national park and a UNESCO World Heritage Site, home to a quarter of the world's last mountain gorillas. It's also a place that's fallen prey to poachers, rebel fighters and now oil interests after a British company, Soko, was allowed to drill in the park in 2010. In a new documentary, Virunga, filmmaker Orlando von Einsiedel portrays those who protect the site from those local and international threats.
The film reveals the violence that surrounds those eerily beautiful forests and shows the daily fight the park's director, Emmanuel de Merode, faces to continue preserving the park, a fight that almost cost him his life a few weeks ago as he was shot four times during an ambush. Well, I'm delighted to say we're joined now by both the film's director, Orlando von Einsiedel, and journalist Melanie Gubi, whose investigative work has highlighted some alarming bribery in an attempt to further oil exploration in a park that remains a protected site. I welcome both to the programme, Orlando and Melanie. Orlando, if I can start with you, watching the drama, the sort of the human drama and the natural drama that's implicit in this movie, you talk about how the same kind of sort of lack of oversight that's beset Congo for centuries is being played out today. Were you very aware that this was merely the latest sort of chapter in a rather alarmingly long story of the same kind of events unfolding time and time again?
Well, I actually, to be honest, when I first went out there, this isn't a story I set out to tell. I set out to tell a story of hope. The region had been in, had a kind of period of stability between 2008 and 2012. And I came across the story of the inspirational and brave rangers of Virunga National Park. And I saw in their story a metaphor for telling a story about the wider rebirth of Eastern Congo as a whole. And so I came out and I started documenting the park's great work of pushing forward development projects and tourism. And sadly, within about 3 weeks of being on the ground, this new civil war started. And then I learned about the park's concerns about illegal oil exploration by Soko International.
And Melanie, you've been in Congo now for several years, and talk us through why you first went out there, because at the time it wasn't really to do with gorillas in a national park, was it?
No, I first went there to train women Congolese journalists in radio and print, and I spent a year doing that and producing a radio program about justice for Congolese radio stations. And after a year, the conflict with the M23 rebel group started. So my work began being more about freelancing and doing reporting myself. And, you know, the oil issue was always something that I was interested in covering, because it's such a big problem right now in Congo. And I met Orlando at that time. So we started working together.
And tell us a little bit about as the film came together and the ideas for it came together, because it's an intriguing blend of sort of documentary, wildlife documentary, undercover journalism. It's quite a sort of heady blend, and presumably that can almost threaten to get out of control. In terms of sort of controlling that narrative, which is such a kind of spiraling and compelling story, how did you kind of get to grips with it? Because there's so many conflicting and contrasting elements to try and bring to the screen.
That there are. I mean, it was, to be honest, as a filmmaker, it was really difficult, because we probably could have made about five different types of film. As you say, you shoot hundreds of hours of material, and then it's kind of about battling that down in the edit and sitting there for several months pulling your hair out and trying to tease out the different storylines and trying to make it all make sense. It was really tough, but I hope people like it when they watch it.
And Melanie, throughout the last 10, 15 years, the national park in Virunga has been a battleground. It's been this oasis of calm at times. Talk to us about why it's so important to people in eastern Congo.
Well, so as you say, the park is very much at the heart of the conflict zone, and it suffered tremendously throughout the 20 years of war that Congo, eastern Congo, has gone through. But in recent years, largely thanks to Emmanuel de Merode and his work, the park has gone through a rebirth, and the animal population has started growing back, and tourism is now a possibility again. They've put in place infrastructure for tourism, and that is for the region, it's a potential for economic development. And a large part of the Congolese conflict is due to poverty. Young men who are unemployed and have no other choice but to take up arms to find a way to make a living. So the park can offer jobs and economic perspective for young people, and with that, hopefully bring some sort of stability to the region. So people are very, very aware of that, and that's why there are many people who want to protect it.
As well as those opportunities, of course, the park offers this incredible cast of characters who we meet throughout the film. I wanted to ask you, Melanie, about in particular some of the, I guess, the villains of the piece. There's a lot of, you know, hidden camera photography. It's quite nerve-wracking. It seems, I mean, as a viewer, it's actually quite terrifying. And I wondered what that experience was like, because there's some pretty dangerous people and you're dealing with some very, very difficult subject matter. I wondered, were you scared a lot of the time, or did you always feel that you were kind of in control of what was happening?
Oh, I think any journalist that does hidden camera work doesn't like it. It's not fun. But I was working with a wonderful team, and Orlando was a great support. So, you know, in terms of security, you know, there was always someone who knew where I was, and all the hidden camera work was done in public places. So, you know, it was obviously a bit, I was a bit nervous, but we had a lot of security measures.
She's being very modest. She's a very brave woman.
And Orlando, let's talk a bit more then about what the oil company is trying to do there, because, you know, they've issued all sorts of declarations about this film, saying, oh, no, we would never threat anyone, we're definitely not bribing anyone, we're not doing anything that could possibly be construed as illegal. What is the threat to Virunga National Park from oil drilling?
Well, I think there's several things. I think, firstly, it's a rule of law issue. What Soko International are doing is illegal. It's illegal under Congolese law. It's illegal under international law. You cannot explore for oil in a World Heritage Site. It's that simple. So that's the first thing. Secondly, over the 2 years that me, Melanie, and the team of Congolese people that we were working with on this, we've uncovered a whole range of issues that suggest that there's a serious lack of oversight on the part of Soko International. And that specifically relates to issues to do with bribery and corruption and links to armed groups.
When we look at the role of organisations like Soko International, they're not the ones, the big oil companies that we've all necessarily heard of. But in places like Congo, it tends to be these sort of outside groups, isn't it, that do the dirty work first. And then if they do think there is enough oil, they will then perhaps down the road sell it on to a Chevron or an Exxon or someone like that.
Well, I mean, Soko International's own CEO has sort of publicly stated that they often work in the axis of evil, as it were. I mean, yes, they, you know, this is a company, they're known as wildcat companies in the oil industry, where they go into risky places, and they're the first ones to prospect for oil, and then if they find it, then perhaps they sell it on to one of the bigger oil companies that we know of and we see on the high street and we can buy petrol from.
It's important also to note that Total, the French oil company, has a concession north of the park, which is very similar to Soko's concession. But they've promised that they would not go into the park and they would not explore for oil in the park. So Soko's behavior is by no means reflecting what other company in the oil industry would do. They're the only one doing it.
One of the potential threats to the park is, of course, to the creatures that live there. And it would be remiss not to mention some of the other sort of undisputed stars of the film, in particular the mountain gorillas. I always wonder when documentary filmmakers, or wildlife filmmakers for that matter, record these incredible creatures and how they live. And the filmmakers always say, well, you know, you can't become involved and you mustn't anthropomorphize these creatures and you have to stay detached. That's got to be pretty difficult, I'm guessing, Orlando, isn't it? Because they're so charming, they're so incredible, and they're at such immediate threat. Were you able to keep that safe distance, or did you find
Tom
that you were...
hasn't been when watching it.
I've been in hysterics, basically.
Do you know what? With primates, you can't help but anthropomorphize them. But just, I mean, they are so like us. It's incredible. I mean, when you look at... I always remember it was holding the orphan gorillas that Andre in the film, he looks after these four orphan gorillas whose parents have been killed. And it's when you hold their hands and you see their fingernails and the way they clasp that, your hand, just it's so human. And there's one particular scene in the film where the gorilla caretakers, they're tickling one of these orphans. And it's, you know, under the armpits like you tickle a human. And this this gorilla is laughing like so human. So, I mean, you know, I'm a fairly cold-hearted person, but I couldn't. My icy heart was melted pretty much every day I was out there.
One other character that we have to talk about is Emmanuel de Moreau, the park's director, who, as we said at the beginning, was recently shot. He's now recovering in hospital, and we wish him well. But talk to us a bit, Melanie, about the role that Emmanuel de Moreau has played in the park's survival over the past few years, because he's the man really that sort of overall has kept things going.
So Emmanuel was appointed as the park director in 2008, and as such he became a civil servant of the Congolese state. So he's very much working for the Congolese state and working for the Congolese people. And his work has been to bring together conservation and development and make sure that the population has a role in preserving the park, because as we said, you know, it's an area where there's been a lot of violence and there is a huge demographic pressure on the park as well. So Emmanuel understand that, you know, making people part of preserving the park is the only way forward. So he's started implementing a development project around the park to have people benefiting from the park itself. And obviously tourism will, you know, bring jobs, as we say. So in that sense, Emmanuel's vision is very unique, and you know, it makes a lot of people hopeful in the region that not only the park will be preserved, but that this will help things move forward for the region.
And yeah, of course, yeah, as you show in the film, a couple of years ago, civil war started again. One could ever really say it stopped in eastern Congo when the M23 rebels, a group backed by Rwanda, came into Goma and threatened to go even further. As much as that threat may have receded now, the fact that Emmanuel was shot just a few weeks ago, Orlando, shows just how volatile the situation remains there.
I think what's the take from what happened to Emmanuel is just how dangerous the work of the Rangers is. And if you can take one thing from it, it's why the Rangers are willing to do such dangerous work. And the answer is really simple. It's because they believe so wholeheartedly in the potential of the Virunga National Park to transform the region and drive sustainable development, which ultimately could lead to lasting peace.
We are going to have to leave it there. Orlando von Einsiedel and Melanie Gubi, thank you both very much indeed for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. Virunga is currently on the international festival circuit. And indeed, where can we find it next?
Well, the best thing to do is to look on our website, www.virungamovie.com. There's a list of screening dates and we're adding new ones all the time.
Orlando, Melanie, thank you both very much for joining us on the Weekly. It's music time. Tom, would you like to hear something new from Leroux?
Steve, you know that I would.
Okay, here we are.
That was LaRue with Let Me Down Gently. What did you make of that, Steve?
I wouldn't let you down any other way, Tom.
What a great guy you are.
You're listening to The Weekly. More to come after this.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programmes to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
In 1993, Sigrid Rasing, who's now the owner of Granta, amongst other things, was an anthropology PhD student doing fieldwork on a collective farm in post-Soviet Estonia. Rasing had gone to Estonia to find out how the people there viewed their own history after the repression and censorship of the USSR era.
The PhD eventually became an academic book, but today Rasing has decided to publish a more personal memoir of her time spent in a remote area of Estonia's west. The book is called Everything is Wonderful and encompasses memories of a world that no longer exists and a social invention, the collective farm, that we have very much forgotten about.
I'm delighted to say that Sigrid now joins us. Sigrid, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
Now, as Tom says, I mean, let's talk about the title first of all. It's Everything is Wonderful, but I particularly like the subheading Memories of a Collective Farm in Estonia, which I imagine if you'd just had that as the title, might have not found its way anywhere near the front of a bookshop.
Yeah, it's a kind of ironic juxtaposition between the title and the subtitle. The title came about because a bit more than halfway through my fieldwork, I gave a talk to visiting diplomats about the peninsula and how I saw the transition. And the headmistress of the school where I was teaching wasn't very happy with my talk and let me know that. And I said to my neighbors and friends by then, you know, what should I have said? You know, this was a deep austerity Estonia after a winter of minus 33 degrees and not much heating. And he said, ironically, that everything is wonderful. And it struck me as such a Soviet thing to say, you know, he was being ironic about it. But she, the headmistress, actually was quite serious in the Soviet idea of talking places up, you know, talking everything you do up, which, you know, they had to do.
And did you find that when you were there at the time and trying to do this work, that you always had these sort of these conflicts of people trying to talk up Estonia and what was going on and the work they were doing, and yet also trying to be honest about their situations?
No, not really. When I was there, 93, 94, was sort of the end of the independence fervor, you know, the kind of exuberance of the independence in 91. And so people were very tired and very impoverished. And so there wasn't much of that. I mean, people just kind of huddled down and drank and endured, you know.
And let me ask you a bit about the idea of these sort of collective memories, because it's interesting when you consider the backgrounds of people and how they see themselves, how they see their own cultural heritage when you've had these incredible differences. Do you think this is a story about people who maybe do find it a little more difficult to define their own heritage, to define their national identity because of these conflicting influences that have been acting over history? Or did you find that people who you spoke to had a very clear sense of what it was to be from where they came from?
One of the things that I was looking at was how a people in a very remote part of Estonia, in what had been the border protection zone, so really very remote, even in a small country, how they remembered the horrendous events of the 20th century. So, you know, Estonia was on the outskirts of, but still part of what Tim Snyder called the Bloodlands, you know. And so that was the war, but also the Holocaust. Before that, there was the Russian Empire, first revolution of 1905, then the First World War, then the War for Independence, brief independence democracy until 1934, when Konstantin Pets, the president, instituted a kind of authoritarian regime. And then, of course, the Soviet invasion. And another war, the Second World War, the Holocaust, the Nazi occupation, and then the Soviet occupation. So, in other words, most of the 20th century movements, most of the 20th century wars had been fought on Estonian soils. Very traumatic stuff. And I was interested in the context of the Soviet repression of history, what people remembered. It was a post-catastrophe situation. And in that sense, it had a very strong, almost science fiction feel about it, you know, because the people who were left were so much survivors, but they didn't quite recognize or remember that. So, for instance, I looked at the population figures. Every village on the peninsula had declined dramatically in terms of population. There was maybe on average 10% left, except the village where I lived, you know, which was more or less the same. Because half the population, the Swedish half, had left during the war. And then many, many other people had left, fled. Many people had been deported in the 1949 deportations, just before collectivization. And none of that people really remembered. You know, people remembered a bit, but it was very fragmented. And I compare it in the book with Orwell, 1984, when Winston goes to a pub to ask the proles what they remember. Was life better before or after the revolution? And he finds that all they remember are kind of stray, odd details. And it was very like that.
I was in Tallinn about 2 or 3 months ago. And one of the things that struck me at the time was that Estonia seemed to be, in some ways, incredibly modern country. And you look at now the stuff they've done on digital government, it's the birthplace of Skype. And yet also that history is incredibly important. And they talk about not gaining independence in 1991, but regaining it. And a very quick to remind you, actually, Estonia's been independent now for, or first won its independence 96 years ago. Did you find when you were there in 93 and 94, there was this sort of conflict, internal conflict between how much we remember the past and how much we prepare ourselves for a new future?
I mean, what I found was a society that remembered nothing. And what I predicted was that, you know, there would be various forms of memorializing in the whole region of the Soviet Union. That's what I expected at that time. And it didn't really happen in Russia because they had such an ambivalent relationship with the past. But it did happen in Estonia. And the Estonians were very good about memorializing the Soviet past and, you know, the Institute for Historical Memory and so on. And, you know, I think now it's a very different country. When I was there, none of that had happened. None of that existed. You know, that consciousness of the past, it was really before that had begun.
And what about the collective farm? You mentioned in the introduction this sort of social invention. What role, when you spoke to people, had the sort of institution of the collective farm played for the nation? Was it something that was regarded through rose-tinted spectacles? Was there a lot of awareness about some of the, you know, the tougher realities of the lives that people led who worked there? What was your sense of how people then managed to make sense of the memories they did have, given how fractured those memories were?
Of course, our view of collective farms are very coloured by the starvation in Ukraine and what happened a generation before. The Baltic states were collectivized in 1949, and the collectivization itself was preceded by, well, I say nationwide, it was nationwide, but primarily aimed at the countryside. So they were deporting the so-called kulaks, I mean, i.e. the wealthier farmers. And the idea of that was in March 1949. And the idea of that deportation was to prepare the way for collectivization. The idea was to weaken the resistance to collectivization. And so, you know, there was this very bloody history that people, when older people remembered a bit of, middle-aged people didn't really talk about, didn't really know about often. And so, you know, because the history of the deportations had been suppressed, and many people, when they left Siberia after Stalin's death, had to sign papers saying that they would never talk about it. And so even if you were released in 1953, say, and you've signed a paper that you can never talk about it, but you're allowed to go back to Estonia, and many people were released into internal exile to Russia, for instance, and it's still, you don't know really what's going to happen. And the liberalization under Khrushchev, you know, was quite brief, and quite soon the climate started hardening again. And you don't learn about it in school. And so eventually people just try to get by, you know. I found some nostalgia for the collective farm because, you know, most people felt that life was better during the collective farm period. And the reason for that is, of course, that the austerity period when I was there was so harsh. And that, you know, the welfare state that did exist, the collective dining room, the creche, that had been closed down. The cultural program, which was quite extensive. You know, they had film showings, they had theatre once a week. All that was gone, closed down. And so people had lost quite a bit, you know, maybe more than we can see in the West.
Before you go, can we ask you just briefly about Granta, which went through a bit of a rough patch, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
A year or so ago, a number of staff leaving, and it was one of those things that was written about in the arts page of the Liberal Press. But it's been not a bad year for you so far with the Luminaries being such a huge success and winning the Booker. Where does Granta stand now? How confident are you about the future?
Well, it's been a great year. That culminated in our shortlisting for Best Independent Publisher of the Year. And so, you know, I think the atmosphere within Granta is very vibrant, very young, very, you know, enthusiastic. And we all feel very confident about the future and where we're going. And as for the magazine, when John Freeman left, I took over as acting editor. And from next issue, I'm going to be editor. Then, you know, what we'll do is we're thinking about two recruitments and then we'll stop it there and stay more or less where we are.
And do you think with the magazine that it's, you know, because it's one of those rare things in that it, you know, most people who get it, correct me if I'm wrong, subscribe and it arrives through the letterbox if your letterbox is big enough.
Yeah.
Because you say magazine, but I mean, it is, frankly, it's a book, isn't it?
It's a book. Yeah.
It's a book. Are you finding that there is still that interest in the actual physical book and that you're not getting a lot of your subscribers saying, you know what, this would be lovely on a Kindle?
Yeah, no, but I mean, it exists as an e-book too.
Sure, but I mean, it's obviously the sort of thing that it's the actual printed copy seems to be the sort of thing that people want.
Yeah, I think they do want it. People like the design of it. They like the feel of it. They like the fact that it's never changed. You know, the format is the same. So quite a few people have all the Grantas, you know, and that's kind of nice. You know, it's a good thing. It's a good thing. We want to keep it like that.
Sigrid Rousing, thank you very much for coming in. The book is called Everything is Wonderful, Memories of a Collective Farm in Estonia. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
Up next, we analyse the origins of Argentina's dirty war with Federico Finchelstein, who's got a new book out on that very subject.
It's a green thumbs up from us for Tokyo's leading flower market and auction, where merchants indulge in the business of buying blooms.
The Japanese flower market is the place for perfectionists. Anyone looking for a branch of cherry blossom just before it flowers, or a blemish-free orchid with every flower facing the same way.
Blooms or Bust, a photographic essay on the Otta flower market, now showing in the film section on monocle.com.
Argentina's fascist history, particularly its links to Nazi war criminals after the end of the Second World War, are well known. But it's long been considered that the country's own dirty war, one of the most horrendous dictatorships of Latin America, was itself an import from Europe.
In his new book, The Ideological Origins of the Dirty War, historian Federico Finchelstein explores the roots of fascism in Argentina. He spoke with Monocle's Daphne Denis.
Basically, the dirty war was a process where the Argentine state, in that case a military junta that took power in 1976, launched a campaign against citizens that were identified as political enemies by the generals, and these citizens were systematically put in concentration camps, first kidnapped, then put in concentration camps, and eventually killed. I mean, the euphemism which was used by the junta at the time was disappear, that these people were disappeared, but we know in fact that actually that was an euphemism to refer to the fact that these people were being killed by the Argentine state.
This is obviously the story of those grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo that we know so well about, who are looking for their grandchildren who disappeared as well in the dictatorship of Videla. But what you've set out to do with this book is to trace the origins of that dirty war and perhaps prove that fascism wasn't just a European concept, that it was also very much something that developed in and of itself in Argentina.
Yes, I mean, that's a very perceptive way of putting it. Basically, in the book, what I want to know is why the killers kill. I mean, why these people were somehow justifying in their minds that Argentine citizens with different ideas had to be killed. Or different political positions had to be killed. So why the killers kill? And my answer is that behind their decision to kill and their motivation to kill was an ideology which at its roots emerged from the fascist tradition of Argentina, starting in the 1920s and 1930s, and then being reformulated throughout the 20th century, reaching this climax of violence, which was the Dirty War.
So according to you, how did this fascist mentality form back in the 1920s?
Well, I mean, the 1920s are the moment where fascism emerges worldwide. And it is important to remember that fascism was a global ideology with different national variations, which means then that fascism in Argentina share many similarities with other fascisms, such as Italian fascism or Nazism. These two are the most famous of them. But also it generated specific Argentine traits. And among them was the fact that in Argentina, fascism was presented as being a central component of the Christian religion, which is to say that in Argentina, as the fascists would present it, there was a Christianized fascism, as they call it.
So that's very much something that was in the news only last year when the Pope was elected. This was something that came up because obviously Pope Francis was a priest at the time of the Videla dictatorship, and he was accused at the time of not really speaking up, not really saying anything against what was going on. Is that something like sort of a reproach that has been made to most people in the church, and has Argentina's church apologized for it?
Well, yes and no. And the Pope is a subject that is analyzed in the book. Specifically, by the end of the book, I try to analyze the role of the Pope and the role of the politics of memory of that dirty war in current Argentine politics. But going back to the 1920s and 1930s, one would have to say that as opposed to other examples of fascism, including the very much contested relation between Mussolini and the popes, I would say that in Argentina, what was striking in the 1920s and 1930s was the fact that many members of the upper hierarchies of the Catholic Church agreed with this fascist political vision of the nation. Now, that was reformulated throughout the different decades in Argentine history, but eventually by the time of the military dictatorship in 1976 and the Dirty War, what you have is a majority of bishops basically not speaking out, and many of them actually supporting the military dictatorship in their killing campaign. So to put this in actual numbers, out of the 84 bishops of the National Bishop Conference in Argentina at the time, only four explicitly made reference to the fact that they opposed human rights violations at the time. A majority among the other 80 members actually supported that campaign, and also other members, and I think the current Pope will be among them, remain in silence. So the question is, what is the meaning of this silence? And to say the least, the silence means that, you know, there is no actual objection to the campaign.
In the book, so as we were saying, you go from the 1920s, and there's a very interesting chapter where you analyse Perón's relationship with fascism. You say he wasn't a fascist, but it's interesting to look at what Perónism meant to that concept. What were your conclusions?
Well, I mean, the chapter on Peronism is a very interesting detour of the entire history that the book traces, which is the history of the Dirty War through the genealogy of fascism in Argentina. That is to say, what fascism was in the 1920s, 1930s, 40s, 50s, the emergence of the Cold War, and so on. And Peronism is a detour because Perón, who was coming actually out of that fascist tradition, he was a strong man in a military dictatorship that emerged in 1943, that actually was quite close to the fascist model of government. Perón realized by 45 that it was not possible to, if he wanted to be politically successful, to continue with the fascist tradition as it was understood at the time. And by the fascist tradition, one should at least generalize a couple of traits. One of them is that war is the means to achieve more power. So more war, more power, then the persecution of the enemy, racism. I mean, and regarding the enemy, an absolute notion of the enemy as an enemy of the nation, and so on and so forth. So basically, Perón realized that that was not possible for the emerging Argentina of the early Cold War context. And coming out of a dictatorship, he did the opposite of what the fascist leader had done. As you know, Hitler and Mussolini used the electoral process, used democracy to destroy it from within. The Argentine fascists agree with that strategy, but Perón did the opposite. Coming out of a dictatorship, being the strong man, the vice president, minister, secretary of labor, and many other positions, he decided to engage in open elections, and he won presidential elections. So out of a dictatorship, he created a democracy, an electoral democracy. So as opposed to fascism, which emerges from democracy and destroys democracy from within, Peronism emerged from a dictatorship and created an authoritarian democracy, but a democracy nonetheless. So he actually created what actually is the first modern example of modern populism, which nowadays is centrally important both in Europe and Latin America.
Looking back at sort of the tricks that you're trying to find for Argentine fascism, are there other things that you found to be very specific to Argentina in your research, aside from the role of the church?
Well, I mean, one striking issue is the particular history of anti-Semitism in Argentina and how that was actually strongly equated with the fascist idea of the nation. And let's go back to the Dirty War and think that among the victims of the Dirty War, which were Argentine citizens counting on the thousands, I mean, figures range from 15,000 to 30,000 victims. The Argentine Jewish population was less than 1% of the nation. Between 10 and 15% of the victims of the dictatorship were of Jewish origin, were Argentine Jewish citizens. So how do we explain this? And that is something that the book focuses on because I feel that that is central to the history of fascism in Argentina. That is to say that victims will be told in the concentration camps that with other type of victims that actually the perpetrators were killing, they believe it was part of their duty, whereas with killing or torturing Argentine Jews, for them it was fun. And fun is not, I mean, I analyze this ideologically. What would be something that provides a political and ideological pleasure to these perpetrators? And talking about a band of sadistic personalities, but rather a band of committed ideological warriors. And anti-Semitism was central to the equation. So by killing and torturing Argentine Jews, they were fulfilling the premises of fascist ideology in Argentina.
Obviously, during the Dirty War, one of the also like the people that were prosecuted as well were obviously left-wing, the people that were accused of being communists. Was there a link between those two things, or was it like sort of a common scapegoat?
Well, it is very hard to make sense of the ideology of the perpetrators from, let's say, a different understanding of politics and certainly the one that I strongly identify with, which is that of democracy. So basically, whoever they feel that was an enemy, it was quickly identified with communism, Judaism, and other things that the perpetrators saw as having a negative impact on Argentine politics. But to put it simply, if somebody was basically engaged or identified with leftist politics or had a Jewish origins, the possibility of being kidnapped or tortured by the dictatorship was higher. But the rationale of the dictatorship was really related to a particular understanding of the enemy that they enforced. That is to say that at the end of the day, the enemy was whoever they wanted it to be, being leftist, Argentine Jewish citizens, or even people of center or even right politics.
My last question to you, Federico, is obviously, like, we see the remnants of fascism in Italy, and, you know, we have sort of like those fringe right-wing extremist groups that remain in Europe very much present. Is there something like that in Argentina?
Not as much as it is in Europe right now. I'm actually very worried about the European situation more than I am about the Argentine one, in the sense of the extreme right politics. Because basically what you have in Europe is these examples of modern populism that in a way somehow reproduce important traits of the Peronist model that Perón created. I mean, and then of course you have populism of the left and of the right. But Peronism was both. And in Europe you have this identification of basically immigrants as being incapable of being members of the nation with other authoritarian traits. And yet there is no objective, at least in most cases, let's say the case of the National Front in France or in the Netherlands. In Western Europe, you don't have a disengagement with the electoral process so far, which is not the case in other most problematic cases such as in Greece or in Hungary, for example. But there is always the chance that a populist movement that is attached to democracy sometimes in a very formalistic way will basically leave democracy behind. That is not the case in most European cases at the moment, but one cannot rule out that possibility.
That was Federico Finchelstein speaking to Daphne Denis about his new book, The Ideological Origins of the Dirty War. And that book is out right now. You're listening to The Weekly on Monocle 24.
And that brings us almost to the end of this 255th edition of the Monocle Weekly. Steve, that was quite some show. Particularly struck by the stories about Virunga National Park there. Because, you know, we were talking about this earlier, my sort of monkey, I have a general monkey enthusiasm.
You do. You have a general sort of monkeyish outlook on life as well.
Yeah. And obviously the story is equal parts, you know, harrowing. There are things to celebrate, but there's a good measure of monkey business included, which I do always welcome, even if it can be a little bit of a tearjerker at times.
There really is. It was the one thing that I never got round to doing when I lived in East Africa, was actually go and see the mountain gorillas, despite going to Rwanda, Uganda, and Eastern Congo several times to each. It was almost like
you had an actual job of work to be doing.
Yeah. It's also, I mean, you know, if you are interested, you really should go, but it's quite expensive for like a half day thing. It's about $500 now just to go up.
That is quite dear,
a mountain for.
But if
half
you're passing
day,
by anyway,
and then also you might not see them. That's the thing.
Well, I would insist. I'd need some kind of guarantee.
I think they say if you don't see them, you get to go back another day. But still, I mean, it is, if you are interested in that sort of thing, then it is, I'm sure, worth the money.
It's one of the stops, Steve, on my celebrated international monkey tour that I'm putting together. Don't know when I'm
going
to do it.
Where else are you going?
Oh, it's global. I can't list them all now. We don't have enough time.
Okay. Well, we'll make it Congo then, not Uganda, and definitely not Rwanda. Because also, if you go to Congo, you can go to the volcano as well.
But you told me a horrifying story about the volcano.
Yeah, the volcano.
I don't think this is funny.
No,
it's
really not. But it's just the volcano is not good. Shall I just leave it at that?
Let's leave it at that. People can use their imaginations,
yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Steve, nevertheless, it is the end of the show. Thanks for joining me here. It's been what a pleasant way to while away a Sunday.
It was very nice indeed to spend the Sunday lunchtime with you. I'm off to have a Sunday lunch.
Good. Well, before you leave, we should give our thanks to our producer, Daphne Denis, and to our studio manager, Claire Urban. Robert Bound and Andrew Tuck, regular listeners, will be delighted to learn. We'll be here again next week. But it is, for now, goodbye from both me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.